I'm Amy.
I'm Delia.
And I'm Wendell. And welcome to
Yes
But
Why
Podcast. Yeah.
Thank you, Kevin McDonald, for joining us in the Yes But Why Podcast.
I'm nodding. Thank you very much.
Today's a special day, not only because we have Kevin, but we also have a guest host, my husband and lead of the podcast Dudes and Beer, Chris Jordan. Hello.
Hey, how you guys doing? Thanks so much for having me in.
Yeah, absolutely. And then me and sweet, sweet Wendell to rock it in.
Yeah. This is early for me.
Yeah, it is early in the day.
This is morning time.
We right usually now. Record at night, like after 6 p.m. So this early morning stuff is wild. We're drinking coffee. Deli is at work.
I will explain to the microphone. Yes. You see, microphone, I have a flight later today, so we're doing it early.
Thank you very much, kind to do it on the day of
for
the
all
flight.
Of our microphone listeners out there.
Thank you, microphone.
Yes.
So many of them. Well, cool. Thank you so much for being here. We like to... the purpose of this podcast is kind of to talk to people about the journey of their lives doing art and being a theater artist and what that's been like as a journey. And I feel you bring a lot to the conversation because, you know, you've been doing it for a long time.
I was going to say, because I'm old, older people have to bring in a lot more than the younger people.
It's a fact of life.
it's really funny. I noticed Quentin... from the theater, mm-hmm. Taking a picture with you and then posted this blurb that was very complimentary, but he was like, so I grew up loving Kevin McDonald and Lilo and Stitch and these things. And then I found Kids in the Hall in college and I was like, oh man. I was like,
it made you feel
we
old,
were
didn't
peers. Before I read this in my head, I was like, ooh.
The biggest Kids in the Hall fans are aged 37 to 42, who were in college when Comedy Central was doing our repeats.
Yeah.
37 to 42 year olds are our market number.
Yeah. And, I actually found you guys in high school. A friend of mine, I was one of the few people that didn't have like cable. I had basic cable, but I didn't have cable. Okay, so okay. I didn't get to see like y'all stuff whenever it came out.
Right.
But I had a friend of mine that told me about y'all. And he was like, dude, you like Saturday Night Live and said, like, you got to check out Kids in the Hall. He was like, it's by, you know,
Lorne
the
Michaels.
Same people, Lorne yeah, Michaels, yeah. You know? It's
yeah, not many people saw us when we were first running HBO. I hesitate to use the word success. We became the cult success that
exactly.
we are through Comedy Central. In fact, our first comeback tour... I remember we'd been off the air for like 5 or 6 years, but people thought that a lot of people thought the repeats were for real. So I remember we got off the bus in St. Louis, and all these teenage girls were so disappointed to see how old we were. And they were wearing signs, and their faces dropped, and they looked maybe that we were the dads of the Kids in the Hall.
Dads in the Hall. It's the new. Dads dads
everybody
new
just
show.
Grow a goatee so you can claim you're the evil twin of the Kids in the Hall.
Yeah, I grew up like catching the reruns late at night on Comedy Central, being very confused immediately. I remember just being like, this is such offbeat humor. And it was so not like Saturday Night Live, but it was just, that's what made me keep coming back. I was just like, I need to laugh at that.
I had a similar experience when I was young watching Monty Python.
Oh,
when it came out in Canada, I was like 10, and I didn't understand it, but I knew something special was happening.
Right.
And so I kept watching it until I got it. I got things like the fish slap dance, where John Cleese, where Michael Palin slaps John Cleese with a little fish. And then, it's such a great comedy thing, then John Cleese answers by getting a giant fish and knocking him in the river. And and even that was weird, but as a kid, I knew that was
something
silly.
To pay attention to.
Yeah.
That's funny. When I was looking at comedy as a child, it was mostly stand-up. It was like right when cable started, you know, like back in the day, you know, there's 5 channels and then all of a sudden they're like, there's cable. And my parents were like, we're getting it for you kids to raise us. And and so I watched all these channels and silly them, you know, they're like my age in this story and they don't know that they're letting their child watch things that could be insane. And so all hours of the day there'd be stand-up and I watched so much George Carlin and like Eddie Murphy, things I should not have been watching as like an eight-year-old or whatever. Yeah. So that was how I got into comedy first, and didn't even realize sketch comedy was a thing until, you know, I was in high school, and then somebody was like, you know, you can also do this. And I was like, oh, that's, you don't just have to be alone with a microphone, which seems very intimidating.
Again, I have a similar story.
Yes, sir, with your hand raised.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm explaining the microphone. I'm raising my hand before I talk. When I was a teenager, I was already entrenched in stand-up, sketch comedy, because of Monty Python, Saturday Night Live, and SCTV.
Yes.
But also the stand-up comedy was beginning. So they were on TV a lot. There were a lot of stand-up comedy shows. So I was seeing a young Jay Leno and a young Jerry Seinfeld, and when I saw Steve Martin, it was amazing. And that was exciting to me, though I felt distance from it. I knew that wasn't sort of what I did. But also it was their clean act. It wasn't HBO or anything. It was like...
Yeah, and
that was the first stand-up boom, late
70s. I actually grew up watching SCTV as well. I mean, the Turning Japanese skit by Rick Moranis is still to this day.
He invented video jockeys.
He
invented it. That was before MTV. He invented it by accident.
And it was
he invented it as a joke to have a disc jockey that you saw. But,
and it was utterly beautiful, like the whole sketch of it.
The joke was, in MTV, they just got good-looking people who didn't seem like disc jockeys. But the joke was, what about typical disc jockey could be seen, which is pretty funny.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Hi, Jerry Todd.
Well,
what's the song? What's the theme song? In the morning with Jerry Todd.
Yeah. there was that, and then for me, there was also was it John Byron's Bazaar?
Yeah.
There was that, and then I remember being snuck out of bed by my grandfather whenever I would go for the summer and like spend a week. He'd come and get me out of bed to come out and watch Benny Hill.
Oh, Benny Hill.
After my grandmother went to bed, like, come on, son, we're going to go out fishing in the morning, but come here and appreciate this with your papa.
Sonny, I never liked Benny Hill. I never liked John. I never liked Bazaar, and I wish I did, because they filmed it in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And the legend was that he got so rich that he bought an island from the Bazaar money.
Yeah.
But I had trouble with it, even though I thought John Byner was really funny. I was like the Carbonette. I had trouble with it because they had naked women on it, and I thought that had no place in comedy.
Yeah.
Or my life.
Well, I guess at the time I was so young that that wouldn't even register. I was watching for Super Dave. I liked Balloon Ball.
Super Dave Osborne.
Like, oh my God.
Once the kids in the hall were, every now and then you're going to remind me of an anecdote, and I'll just bust in. We were at a dinner with Lorne Michaels, actually. He came to Toronto. He came once a year to be Lorne Michaels in front of us. And then Super Dave Osborne was at the another table, and he came over. And he said, I got an idea for you guys for a movie. It wasn't a bad idea that we're on a cruise ship and we're sort of play ourselves, but we each meet a woman played by another kid in the hall. And we got a lot of,
that was
a bad idea.
You
that
was still do that now.
Yes, yeah.
This is possible.
So we're all the divorcees now. Or we're all like, we all divorced our husband of 30 years.
Oh, yeah. The cruise ship could just be a different tone, but you could still pull that whole idea off, I think, you know?
Super Dave.
Yeah. It's like real cruise ships. I mean, like, who's on cruise ships?
Yeah.
Like, people over 35, I assume.
Yeah. Looking for people. If
you go on a cruise ship with people in their 20s, that's the worst cruise ship I've ever been on in your life.
I bet. Dave Foley and I did a cruise ship, the Bare Naked Ladies ship.
Oh,
wow.
it was Sarah McLachlan, Bare Naked Ladies, The Mountain Goats, which is why I started it. Well, the money was great, but I also, because the Mountain Goats were on it, and the Weaker Thans, and it was very exciting. Though, I love people, but the drag was...
Mr. Microphone.
That you're like with everybody who came on board as fans. Mm-hmm. So you're on the ship, being a shy person, I wanted to stay in my room a lot, though I didn't.
Yeah.
Was that like a part of the thing where you had to spend a certain amount of time sort of mingling?
It was unspoken. It was sort of forced upon you. You sort of had no choice.
Yeah. Okay.
So you say that you're a shy person. How did, as a shy person, you get into theater at first?
There we go. Now we get started. Good question.
There it is.
I really only have, I'm not being modest, I really only have one talent. I couldn't do anything else. I was average at school. When I applied, I was okay, but I didn't apply myself a lot. I couldn't be a carpenter. I couldn't be a doctor. My father wanted me to be a lawyer because his father was a famous lawyer in Montreal, but I knew I wouldn't be able to do that. But when you have the sort of comedy talent, you know it right away because people laugh. You make people make noises. So it's kind of obvious. And I was making people make noises a lot. Mm-hmm. And I realized pretty early on that was my bent because I started thinking things about it. At 12, I started realizing that I'm not funny telling jokes. I can't think of jokes, but I'm funny in how I pause and talk. And then, that's called comedy timing. And then, and then my big story when I realized that it was in grade 5 or 6, and we in our English class, we had to write a story and do it in front of the class. And I wrote a funny story about my vacation in the Bahamas where I got a sunburn and got shingles.
Oh.
It happens to me a lot. I have a sunburn right now, microphone. it got gigantic laughs, and the class sort of loved me for like a couple of days. But I didn't care about that. And a few months later, the English teacher gave us another to write something else. And this was before I was 12, so I thought, all right, I wrote my comedy. Now I'll write my Alfred Hitchcock thriller because I was a movie about that. I wrote this thriller about a husband trying to kill a woman and there's a car chase and stuff like that. And I was really excited. And then the day of the class, I was excited to read it. And then when it was my turn, as I started walking to the head of the class, all the kids were going, oh, it's Kevin, it's going to be really funny. Oh my God, Kevin, it's going to be really funny. And I started like feeling so bad. I have this thing about disappointing people.
Yeah.
Yes.
I went to the front of the class. And I pretended to read from it, and I made up a story. It was based on a true story about football. I was a football player because I was in a house league, and my dad ran the team so anyone could play, and I got hurt in the huddle. I broke a rib. So I just started telling them, and they got greater laughs again. And I remember leaving that day to walking home from school, resigned to the fact that I guess it's comedy I'm doing.
Yeah. Yes. Resigned.
Yeah. Did you ever get a chance to read your Alfred Hitchcock thriller?
I still had it till I was, no. That's sad, isn't it? I had it till I was like in my early 20s and I moved from a place to a place and I lost it.
Oh,
I was like,
give it to me, we'll make it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty simple. He tries to blow up the car and she gets out of the car in time. It's like something.
Spoilers.
Oh, so funny.
Oh, I left the milk out.
Yeah, it was something like that.
So what was your first, like, did you do plays in high school? Or, like, what was your first, not necessarily paid, but like, oh, this is a comedy gig kind of thing when you were in a troupe or whatever?
Well, like in high school, I knew I wanted to, see, because I was a comedy, I thought, I don't want to be a stand-up, so I thought more in terms of comedy acting. Mm-hmm. And I thought, later on, all right, I'll become Woody Allen later, but right now it's comedy acting. So they were doing a play called The Death and Life of Sneaky Fitch, and I got a very small part in it. And the kids, the boys with the three bigger parts kept pulling out because they thought it was sissy-ish to be people were making fun of them. And teacher who was directing sort of thought I was good, so I kept getting bigger parts. I mean, I had the lead for a second, then Gordy Steffen decided to quit his job and come back. So he got the lead. He played Sneaky Fitch. I was the second lead at this point, Doc Birch. And I remember it was another thing where I think, oh, yeah, it's comedy that I'm doing. Because there was a scene, I had like a stick horse. It was called Trigger. It was a stupid play. And in one scene, I ride to Sneaky Fitch, and those things that make you go, ah, I called a Gnostic, whatever it's called. I put it in his mouth, and there's like, quote-unquote funny shtick that we do. Now, the guy, the prop guy, I didn't trust, and he was supposed to put the Gnostic in my medical bag, but I didn't trust him, so I put one in without telling him. And then I was riding the Sneaky Fitch, and then I saw the guy in the wings, the prop guy, panicking, going, I forgot the Gnostic. Now, I had the Gnostic in my thing, but then I thought, I thought of an ad lib. So even though I had it covered, I walked to the side of the stage, The trainer wasn't on Trigger. Trigger wasn't with me. So I go to the side of the stage. I take the Ostick, though I don't need it because I think of an ad lib. And I go, thank you, Trigger. You can go home now. And the audience laughs and laughs. And and the director said, it was the best days in the play. and I thought that was my first brave choice because I had the stick. I could have gone with the script. But I thought of an ad lib because he was like panicking. And I thought, and then again, I walked home resigned. Yeah, it's comedy.
So the reason behind doing that, do you think it was just like an audience loves a break or like loves an inconsistency in the story or like what made you think that was going to work?
I was an egomaniac who had thought of a funny joke.
Yeah.
I was 100% convinced that I would get a laugh.
Yeah.
And I also knew the audience would not only laugh, but they would delight in the fact that they knew that something was going wrong.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah.
And I knew that it was the kind of play that wouldn't hurt it.
Okay.
It's not like it's Death of a Salesman.
And I wanted to, in an egomaniac way, share with the world my wonderful idea that I just thought of.
I think comedy is so much about embracing mistakes, especially like sketch and improv comedy. It's all like, oh, did you just trip over? Well, the whole scene's about you tripping now.
Yeah.
Like, or whatever thing it might be, you know.
And the audience has loved that.
Yeah, absolutely. When somebody yells out and you react to it in character, oh my God. They don't even understand how that works.
They love that, yeah.
Yeah, I guess I identify with improv comedy most coming from the point of view of a musician and an audio engineer. mainly because, like, I was never skilled enough as a musician. Like, I can get up and do cover songs all night. I can write my own music, whatever. Hey, you put chords and words in front of me, we're going to jam for hours. But the people that I utterly love to work with as an audio engineer were jam bands.
All right.
And it took this real synergy, not just among stage, but as an audio engineer, going to their rehearsals and learning, like, just the subtle movements, the small things that happen while they're playing that cue the next song and tell me, ooh, I need to bring in this delay. And make this start happening on my end so that it translates between the audience and the stage.
May I tell the microphone that you have a license plate behind your head on the wall that says Deadhead?
There's also one here with one of the members of one of the only keyboardists to survive the Grateful Dead.
Oh, I know, they'll die. It's like Spinal Tap.
I know, right?
I'm sorry, keep going.
No, absolutely. But those were my favorite bands to work with because even though you were doing the same stuff, and I'm sure it's the same way with Kids in the Hall. Like, I went out and saw y'all's performance here, and there were numerous characters that y'all brought in from the show and stuff like that, and there was some new material. But the fans are going to want to see something familiar, but you're not going to want to do it in that same way night after night after night.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. In fact, we started calling ourselves Grateful Dead because after you do the show, the tour is like 30 cities usually, give or take. And after the 7 or 8 show, we started, it would be a different scene every night. We would like go somewhere. And then we always knew when to come back. Sometimes we didn't. Sometimes you go too far.
Exactly.
But like the Grateful Dead, it didn't always work.
And
it worked a lot.
It worked a lot. And most of the time, I mean, people are on so many hallucinogens, they just love it. So,
I think comedy purists actually prefer the idea that it could go wrong.
Yeah.
Like the chance that everything could fail is the joy of being, and I say comedy purists, because it's like, you know, the hoi polloi watching a comedy audience is like, tell me a joke, make me laugh, meh. But like somebody who's like, I'm into comedy, comedy's my thing.
Yeah.
Like love the little bits, the like fun stuff, all the things that are going on.
I just thought of the craziest thing that ever happened. It was the last tour. Maybe it's not the craziest thing that ever happened. But Scott and Mark were doing
it's true.
It's the 85th craziest thing. Scott and Mark were doing the scene. And then the light wasn't exactly on them. They didn't set it right. So I would have just lived with it. But some guy, he goes up on top when they're doing the scene, and I'm from the wings, I'm seeing it. But if that isn't crazy enough, he has a bottle of water with him. And it's a half-drunk bottle of water. And he's crawling on
all the wiring and everything. Yeah.
And he puts the water down, and he's so dumb in a way, I guess. Sorry. And he flips the light, and he knocks the bottle of water, and the bottle of water lands. And I'm seeing this whole thing right between Mark and Scott. And the audience just laughs because it happened. And then Mark did the funniest thing. He took the water. He went to Scott, drink it.
Beautiful. Beautiful. The tech became part of the show. Yeah. Good for him.
And it made sense with the scene, because the scene was him trying to calm down. So he's like, calm down. Here, drink this. That's what it was.
That's great.
Oh, man, it is amazing when it all works out that way. I think that's kind of why, I know that you're saying when you were a child, you were like resigned to doing comedy, but like, I think in the end, it's a better choice, you know what I mean? Because drama is so one thing. The characters get to have a bit more of a like breadth of feeling and emotion and life, you know, right. I'll give you that. They have ups and downs the way comedy characters maybe don't. But at the same time, like, there's the magic of comedy and the chance of comedy. Right. And like, you're about to step off a ledge.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was talking about this with Quentin last night. The microphone, you need to know who
I think he prefers Mike.
The microphone knows you're who so Quentin formal. Is.
The microphone, you know your friend. That the best movies have everything in it. Because we were talking about Woody Allen and how he went to interior after he did Annie Hall, which was brilliant. He did a movie that was just drama, Interiors. And I think he got better at dramas, but he, because he, I could guess, being not Woody Allen good, but being a comedian, I could guess, I'm doing a drama now. I'd better drain all the comedy out of it.
Yeah.
And because of that, it was very, it wasn't like Life, because Life has everything. Whereas his next movie, Manhattan, I think is sort of his best movie, because it has comedy and a dramatic story, mm-hmm. and that's what Life is, comedy and a dramatic story.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. I mean, for me, I guess some of the movies that comedy-wise and stuff really resonate with me the most are the tragedy that happened, like The Jerk. Like this poor guy.
Right.
Like he's living the best life that he knows how to live, but it is just one friggin' tragedy after another.
It's a very funny tragedy.
And that's the beauty of comedy is that this character will go through mishap after mishap and never learn the true lesson.
In a drama, you have to have the redemption.
Right.
The redemption has to happen. In a comedic tragedy, technically it doesn't. The comedy is the tragedy in and of itself. So you don't actually have to have the resolution of something good happening at the end.
Sad comedy, there's the original Heartbreak Kid, not the remake with Ben Stiller. Mm-hmm. No offense, Ben Stiller. but the original one, I don't know if you've seen it, with Charles Grodin and comedy genius Elaine May directed it from 1972. It's the saddest story, really. But I mean, it's a sad story. But it's hilarious about a guy who marries a woman, and they drive from New York to Florida. Bit by bit in the drive, driving their honeymoon, she's annoying him. She keeps saying stuff like, whenever she does something to annoy him, she goes, "Get used to it because you're gonna be living with the next 40 or 50." When she says it the fourth time, goes, "Stop saying that!" And then when they get to Miami, she gets a bad sunburn story, and she has to stay in the room. And then he falls in love with a beautiful woman on the beach. And he starts giving reasons why his wife should stay in the room. I don't think you're recovered enough. And then he, so during his honeymoon, he's sitting on, and it's the saddest story, but it's totally funny and hilarious. But you feel for the wife. And she's a total three-dimensional character. Mm-hmm. She's a little annoying, but she's a human being who gets really hurt.
Yeah.
But it's also hilarious. Yeah. And it's sadder because it's hilarious.
Well, and I guess my question for you as an improv comedian, because Amy always puts it as the fact, like, as myself, as a technician and an engineer, everything must be ingrained into me like a friggin' ninja. Like, it's gotta be a reflex action when something happens. I shouldn't have to think about it. I should just do it and fix the problem. Amy, on the other hand, as an improv comedian, tells me her brain is like that whiteboard. And that, sure, she may think of something and it may be there, but it's got to be able to be gone, and that has to be able to be a blank slate for what's going on.
Right.
Oh. Now, you yourself as an actor and being in movies and stuff, do you use that concept? Do you actually build... Because, I mean, you have some iconic characters, especially in Kids in the Hall and stuff like that. And it does take an investment in yourself to come up with that character, to write that character. How much whiteboard and how much rote ninja memory skill is in there?
See, I do use my comedy part of the brain in my real life, too. But I'm a hybrid of both you guys. train in improv, and that's what we did for a few years at Kitson Hall.
Mm-hmm.
But we are always dying to learn how to write, and eventually, bit by bit, we learned how to write.
Yeah.
And I also love structure. I'm a weird hybrid. Mm. I love the whiteboard, the clean slate, but I also love to put structure on it.
Yeah.
So when I do start using the whiteboard, slowly it gets structured.
Yeah, yeah.
And I love improvising now. It's funny, in the 80s, when the kids and I improvised, even when we did our written shows, we always did 11 scenes. I don't know why it was 11. Well, we did 9 scenes, and 2 of them were improvs. And back then, only Mark McKinney and Dave Foley, I thought, this is my opinion, the guys don't even know that I think this. But
oh, I think they will now.
They went,
yeah.
They were two strong improvisers.
Mm.
Bruce was hilarious in an improv.
Mm-hmm.
Scott sometimes was amazing improviser, and sometimes he wasn't. And I'm probably like, I was probably like that. But I've fallen in love with it over the past 2 years because I'm teaching these workshops that I teach, writing sketches through improv. The theater always asks me to improvise with them. And I've sort of fallen in love with it, and it sort of reinforced my writing. I'm straying away from your question.
No, you're not.
That's not what happens in a podcast.
You're not at all.
Also, straying away from the question, kind of part of the question. So it's cool.
Yeah, kind of. Well, doing part of the question.
You started with the whiteboard, and then you put stuff on the whiteboard. And now you're talking about what's on the whiteboard. I like this whiteboard metaphor. It's a good one. I believe I'm going to use the phrase living in the moment. That's what the whiteboard means.
Yeah. Right, yeah.
Like, I live in the moment, and then it gets erased, and then it's done. Or I say to my students, your brain has to be like an etch-a-sketch. You write the scene, and then you shake it, and it's gone.
And does it affect your life? Do you find yourself yes-anding in your life?
Well, I definitely feel myself yes-anding in my life.
To your detriment?
And I also find myself etch-a-sketching moments. So, like, I'll live, we'll have a great time, and then, like, 2 hours later, Chris will be like, remember that thing? And I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. So, like, my memory bank does not keep much because I'm just trying to constantly throw ideas around in my head.
Right.
The function of my brain is just to continuously be creative versus trying to, like, maintain memories. Like, there's so many people who are like, oh, I remember back in the day. I'm like, I don't care. I'm here now. What are you doing right now?
Yeah.
Like, that was great.
I've taken the place of her memory bank.
He just tells me.
You remember me. All right.
I remember every nuance and everything.
You're a ninja.
Happens.
You're a whiteboard.
That's how marriage goes, I guess. Yes. I let that go now, you know?
Two ninjas probably would last.
No.
Two whiteboards probably would get lost.
Yeah,
definitely. Good Lord.
At least not in the dark. Once the dark comes, like, there can only be one ninja in the room. That's how it works.
And here's the thing about improv. I remember when I was
Highlanders, in, ninjas, whatever.
When I was in a Del Close workshop, when I was 19, is that name dropping? I don't know.
Yeah, every improviser drops that name, so sure.
I remember him saying that how much he loved improv. He would say how much John Belushi loved improv. It's better than sex, John Belushi would say. But he said, some people think improv is a means to a different end, and I think it's a means to its own end. Mm-hmm. And I remember being so happy with myself because, oh wow, I disagree with Del Close. I think it's everyone's opinion, it's different, but I think it's a means to an end. I always intended to do it until I learned how to write. That was always my intention. I know some great improvisers in Winnipeg, a group called Crumbs, and they do the best improv scenes ever. And because I'm whiteboard and ninja, I go, do you everything of writing it down and keeping it forever? And they go, no, we're lazy. It's gone. And it makes me sad that the fantastic half-hour improv, it was one whole story that I saw them do a few weeks ago, is gone forever.
No,
that's the beautiful part.
Yeah, that's the beauty of the whole
you're
thing.
You're the Del Close.
I'm in your camp.
Yeah,
I'm in your camp. Because I'm one of those people, my best friend Billy Stewart, like, used to write poetry and just get rid of it. And, like, I have every word I've ever written.
Every word he's ever written.
Every word.
It's in
like,
my house,
right? Every song, everything. And they're horrible. I'm not going to say they're good.
But you've got them.
But I've got them.
Yeah.
I've got them. And it's one of those, like, he didn't care. It was flippant. Like, he'd write one and tear it up in front of me just to watch me react. And it was like, oh, dude. Like, why would you do that?
See, I'm like that, too. People a little more like us would be hoarders.
Kind of. Yeah, like I said, I was when my friends saw the third turntable this weekend, and they were like, my God, how many turntables do you have? I was like, well, this is the backup for my backup.
The only reason why this is all right in a marriage is because he accepts the fact that I remember nothing.
That's right. See? She won't remember that I'm a hoarder.
I'll be like, oh, we have three turntables in like 2 days, so don't worry about that. Right.
Well, you two, explain to me why improv being dead is good. I did an improv in Seattle. All I remember it was that I thought it was almost brilliant with Randy Dixon from Seattle. And all I remember about it, besides that I thought it was brilliant, was it was about us painting a bathroom blue. And this is so sad to me that I, at least a Kitchen Hall sketch, I don't, but I know that I can go on YouTube and watch it and enjoy it. I don't do that, but I know that I can. Mm-hmm. But that blue paint bathroom is, now I'm interviewing you guys, shut up a second. It's dead to me. So why is that a good thing for you guys?
So for me, like, my thing is, when performing, I love my audience. Like every time I love them, and there are times where it's like I do a show and I didn't feel good about it, but there are times where I did something with my group that I just was so proud of, and I'm so glad I could have given it to that crowd that we all just kind of shared that thing.
So it's a gift.
Yeah, it is. It's a gift. I mean, I could give better gifts sometimes, sure. You know, sometimes I'm re-gifting or like giving something that I didn't want in my house or whatever. But I really love the idea that, like, that's something that none of their friends could get, you know, like, we shared that moment, and then and then I will remember it forever. There are certain shows that I could literally just react out for you right now.
So you remember the blue paint.
Yeah,
but you wouldn't.
I don't. No, I don't remember any of it.
Yeah.
I take excessive notes when I'm coaching and teaching, because otherwise I'll be like, I don't know what just happened, but I feel good. And that means you did a good show. But I can't teach like that, right? So I like it because there isn't anything else in the world like it, in that like Wendell's saying, when you're doing a show and there's a crowd of people, they all get to feel this experience and be part of it. And it's visceral. And it's like, we're all feeling the same things. So like, for instance, on Saturday, when they did the megaphone show.
I was going to bring that up.
They were so good.
It seemed like they were all connected, the audience and the stage.
Absolutely.
A Grateful Dead concert.
Absolutely.
The whole room.
It's the synergy.
Yeah.
It's the synergy.
They felt it. Everybody in that room, the only people that ever get to experience that or those like 100 people that were there. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone felt the same thing. If they were warm, we were all warm. If it were like, you know, when people laughed at things, they were together. It was like such a full unifying moment. And we don't have those, you know, like
a sketch show can be like that, but I guess the energy is slightly lower.
And with a sketch show, like, people, performers and the audience have different expectations for what's going on. They're like, you put effort into this and you wrote it and then you rehearsed it. If it's not, quote, perfect, and perfect is a variable that means many things to different people. If it's not, quote, perfect, they're not into it. Like, there are some times when, like, I'll do a sketch show where we do two of the same show in a month. And if somebody comes and sees the second show or sees both shows, and they can say, oh, well, you did it better last time. That means they were taken out of the experience to have to reflect upon how that went or whatever, or like they know the person. So they're like, I remember when they wrote this or whatever it might be. They're not fully in the moment. Whereas when you're in improv, it's being created in front of you. It's a magic trick of comedy, and everyone's in on it. It gets created by the audience. When the audience reacts, that's what makes the comedy. It's not like, we're going to do this joke whether or not you guys like it. If you're talking about cars for 10 minutes, or not 10 minutes, but if you're talking about cars for 1 minute, and then the audience laughs when somebody sneezes, that you're talking about sneezes. I mean, sneezes are it forever.
Yeah.
And the fact of, like, letting the audience guide you through that thing and just being open to that, I don't know, there's something magical and wonderful
about it. It's a different energy. My argument is, is it a better energy? Because there's an energy to coming up with a sketch idea that I love. Like I said in the workshop, I'm walking my dog Summer and I think of a sketch idea. I drag Summer home, and then Summer and I start writing the sketch. There's an energy I'll follow the steps of the energy. Oh, I just thought of the greatest sketch idea ever. Now I'm writing it. I'm a little disappointed because it never looks good on paper. I'll look at it the next day. I keep working on it. It's getting back to the energy of the idea, and that's energetic. And then I write the sketch, and oh my god, this is great. And then I read it to the kids in the hall, and then it's the and they get laughs. And then the moment where it's performed is this, then again, I'm about to defeat my own argument. even if it does well, I gotta admit that's my second favorite energy of that. My favorite is the first time I thought of the idea.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's yeah.
Exactly. That's and, what the improv is. The first time you thought of that idea, it exists and it's perfect. It's like love at first sight.
Right,
well,
right.
Which you know, real life, whatever, who cares? That doesn't exist in the like real love. It's like infatuation. It's the same with this moment. You're like, ooh, that's fun.
Well, yeah. And see, to me, I guess, because there is a marriage between sketch and improv.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we do Grateful Dead shows.
You do. Oh, you do.
And there's a special energy when we break from it and we...
Yeah. And even as, you know, a musician or as a sound guy, like there's an amount of improv. There's an amount of this is what we do all the time, every time. And whatever happens in between is what happens in between. But for me, I guess coming from a theater background, because that's where I started my tech world, was in eighth grade and theater and all that kind of stuff. And to see the world of theater now, to see shows like, let's just say something iconic, Phantom of the Opera, you know, Les Miserables, that even though they've been around for years, are now an evolving show. There are songs that come in and go out.
Is that true?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's literally become that way. And it blows my mind to know that these were like writ in stone shows.
Right.
But yet still it's gotten to the point because the evolving theater concept has come about. It really started with Jekyll and Hyde and stuff like that where, you know, every other year they would add a new song. They would add
original,
a new thing.
The original writers or the new writers?
Yeah. Yeah. And there are new writers that they bring in too. Yes. But it's interesting to see that, like, as things change in society and stuff like that, that this what people thought was written in concrete concept actually starts changing and morphing. And how much of that do y'all do in your sketch writing? Because I know Amy, even with the neighborhood, has used a few sketches here and there that have been repeats and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
How many times do you actually rewrite things in accordance to how the audience reacts? Because I know bands do it all the time where it's like, dude, when we hit this lick, like, people went nuts. And it was one of those, like,
right,
the ninja in me had that recorder in my rack every time. So our hour and a half long show was recorded and everybody left with it on a thumb drive to rehearse it like football footage.
Right. I'm going to ask your last question in a second. Yeah. I'm going to go back to a few points you were making.
Sure, sorry.
No, it's good. I touched them. It's funny because the sketch the Dave and I did in the Kitson Hall that we hear about the most is a sketch called Citizen Kane. It doesn't matter what it's about, but it's about a guy who saw a movie last night and he's describing exactly Citizen Kane, but he refuses to believe Citizen Kane. And I play the guy who gets mad at Citizen Kane. Now, the people who love that sketch who come up to me, 75% of them have only seen it on the TV show. It has become a completely different sketch. And I always feel disappointed. Oh, you've only seen the TV show. It's become so much more alive through us performing it for the year. In fact, now it's starting to get dead a bit because we performed it for like 30 years. But for the first 20 years, we were sort of rewriting it, not with paper and pen and not before the scene, doing the scene. And it became a completely different thing, a more evolved thing.
Sure.
And that's the Citizen Kane I'm proud of. When I see the show one, it seems flat.
Yeah.
But that's the one that
seems more like a sketch of the sketch.
Yeah, exactly. But and I'm pointing at the wrong song. Oh no, this is Grateful Dead. Jerry Garcia said the same thing. He's disappointed with so many songs. He never liked the recording process.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the way the songs really are now are the way that he does them live, even though he did them differently all the time.
Oh, yeah.
And every night. Dead, by the way. I know.
Every night.
I like to speak in the present tense.
Do you know where he, like, the secret
he's
we know?
Out.
Yeah, yeah. No, he's out there. He's doing it.
He's out there.
He's tired of you guys listening.
I've got a bag of dust. No, I'm just playing.
You were going to react to more things.
Now I forget. What was your last question?
Oh, no, just how frequently do y'all do stuff like that? How frequently is it that you take something that you've written and morph it?
Every time! Because we never plan it. If we sit down and plan it, like on our tour bus before the show, tonight we're going to morph that scene.
No, I know
you don't mean that. Yeah. But I want the microphone to know that...
the inanimate object in the room.
Yes, it happens naturally.
No thumbs or soul.
No, like I bet Grateful Dead... Their first few gigs, they thought they were going to play their songs that they'd written.
Yeah.
And then the songs started evolving. And why are their live albums better than their, or at least more popular?
Yeah.
I actually like...
I love the studio albums of the day.
Working Man's Dead and American Beauty are the two best albums
Absolutely.
Ever. And Garcia's first solo album.
Yes.
There, I could talk Grateful Dead. I could talk German.
And to me, I guess it's the fact of there is that improv, It's the synergy. Like I explain it to people all the time, and they look at me like I'm a freaking hippie Fruit Loop. But literally, with the bands that I worked with in that capacity, I could just like they could. Whenever you're on stage, and you can feel when that change is coming.
Yeah,
you can feel that crescendo. Like
yes.
You're tied into the stage, and you can feel it. And you can feel when the audience ties in between you.
But I'm also a ninja, because I got to admit, the songs from American Beauty and Working Man's Dead, they bore me when I hear the live versions. I like the tight, three-minute versions.
Exactly.
So I'm just contradicting
myself. Yeah, yeah.
Well, no, it was like we were talking about in the workshop about the idea that like you need structure so that you know what the structure is so that you can break the rules.
You need the rules to break the rules.
Yeah, absolutely. If you didn't know what the rules were, you would be
just chaotically breaking rules without, like, it would just be chaos.
Right.
I was actually talking about that because I just started taking sketch. I finished sketch one and I'm going to start sketch two. Tomorrow.
Good luck.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited. I love the teacher. Yeah, it's going to be great. But I brought my younger brother and a buddy that I work with in because it was one of those things, like, my younger brother is not like me. He doesn't want to perform. He wants to make comedy, but he's not really about everybody looking at him all the time.
Sure.
So I was like, all right, birthday present. I'll sign you up for sketch one. I'll take it with you. You know, I've been doing improv, for a while. So I started taking it, and it's one of those things where... You know, that class, I felt like, I was like, okay, now this is, I learned all of this in improv just in a different way, like the three beats, like fish out of water, that kind of stuff.
Even when I say who you are, where you are, that works in both worlds. Sorry.
Yeah. But my younger brother and my friend are like, whoa, three beats, I never thought about that. And it's like, I've been thinking about three beats since I was like eight. Like, where I just understand the formula and stuff.
Three verses in a song, man.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's how it works.
Right. Yeah.
But my buddy was telling me about how, like, he thinks the three beats thing is kind of old hat. And it's something that, like, he's like, well, I'd just rather, like, think outside of the rules. And I was like, well... I get it, because that's sort of the point, is you learn the basics so that you know how to evolve that and how to change it for you. You know, it's like...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'm going to interrupt you because I'm a pig.
Oh, yeah.
Because you've got to...
No, I mean, you have to learn it that way.
I'm a delightful Canadian pig. But you've got to know the rules. Elvis Costello, who was my favorite songwriter for a while, when he first started writing when he was a teenager... He said basically Beatles songs, verse, chorus, bridge. And then when he wrote and wrote, by his third or fourth album, he was doing stuff like verse, bridge, then chorus. Yeah. And it didn't seem forced or pretentious because he knew what he was doing. And it can flow more organically when you know what a rule breaking can even flow more organically when you know what you're doing. But he had to have those 3 or 4 years where he wrote verse, chorus, bridge, verse, chorus, bridge.
It's like Ralph Macchio learning wax on, wax off. You've got to learn the fundamentals, you know, before you can block a punch, you have to learn the mechanics of blocking a punch, my friend. You can't just have one thrown at you at full speed.
Are we going to fight each other now?
If you're a redhead, only one redhead can exist in the room at the same time.
The only problem with that example, however, is that in Karate Kid, he was unaware of what he was learning. And I think it is more important personally for a person to be aware of the rules.
Real world application of that.
Not even that, like... This is the rules of the game, and then you can break the rules of the game.
Well, if you're teaching punk kids, it's a different thing.
All right.
It was an illegal move.
You get crying. It's pretty hard. No, it isn't. You think I don't teach punk kids all day? Because I do.
Hi.
I was like, punk kids are my specialty.
No, I'm just.
I'll structure the shit out of them, and they'll love it. But to the point that Kevin was making, you really do need to spend the time actively creating within the rules before you are able to break them. Because it really always bothers me when level one students, like sketch one students, will be like, the first assignment they hand me something that like has nothing to do with it. And they're like, yeah, this is just what I thought. I'm like, that's super great, but come back with the assignment and then I'll be happy with whatever.
Yeah,
and
right.
Yeah, but I wrote this. And I was like, yeah, I write everything every day. Like, that doesn't matter. I'm not fulfilling. This is a class where there's an assignment. You need to do that assignment.
Absolutely.
Why? Because you need to know how to do that one thing. And that sometimes when people don't do it, I'll tell the class, guys, I'm not teaching you this because like I'm trying to be crazy and I'm trying to be like ridiculous, like strong arm. I want you to have the ability so that say your career moves forward and you're working in, say you get Saturday Night Live. They are like, we need you to write a character sketch for this actor. Right. You need to know how to do that.
Right.
If you're like, well, listen, I only know how to do premise-based sketches. Well, screw you, because that's not what they need right now.
Right.
They need a character sketch, and if you don't know how to create that,
right.
And even we were talking about how Saturday Night Live, as an example, does a lot of game-based three-beat sketches.
Yeah, yeah.
They do that. It's simple. It's quick. It's easy to put in the like television format, and the audience gets it. They're like, oh, he's a jerk. Oh, he's a jerk again. Third time he's a jerk. I love it. Woo! A lot of people are like, oh, I don't like that. I'm not into it. Great. That's awesome. But you need to know how to do it.
Right.
Because the industry in which you potentially would like to get a job
absolutely.
In requires you to have all of the knowledge.
And it improves your own writing. And it helps you find your own voice. The way the Del Close said a thing that I disagreed with. And as a result, I got one step up the stairs of finding my own voice.
Right.
The end doesn't, the means, whatever I said, but the end of the means, I disagree with them. And again, it inched me towards, you need to know the rules to find your own voice.
Yeah, like breaking the rules without understanding why those rules are in place is like why people go to jail and why like things are bad. You know, it's like, like a good cat burglar knows why the rules are there and how to move around them.
Right.
You know, like,
a good cat burglar.
When the Kitchen Hall started in a thing called theater sports, it was our first time. We were 19 and 20, and the first time we were like getting paid for performing. What the theater sports people didn't know is that we were in the second city for 2 or 3 years, and we broke the rules, and they just thought they get them to classes. They don't know what they're doing, and well, the audience is really laughing, and there is a form of structure to our answer. We would do things like, they really hated this. We challenged the theater sports when you challenge teams to games, like improv games. And we challenged the other team to a best scene until Kevin gets an asthma attack. And because I had asthma, and I would run around the stage. And as soon as I started wheezing, and the two kids in the hall would start a scene. And as soon as I started wheezing, they had to end the scene. But our joke was, then it was the other team's turn, but I was already wheezing, so they had to end the scene.
You win every time.
And stuff like that. They just thought it was chaos. They were sort of blinded by the fact that there was structure within our breaking the structure. We knew what we were doing.
Well, it's like real absurdist comedy, and like people that take it to these extremes. Like, you had sent me a text about Eric Andre recently, and it's like, I've been in love with Eric Andre for a minute, and his kind of comedy is very, very like chaotic up front, it seems. You know, it seems to just like not follow any form. But like, Eric Andre is like, in he has studied so much like theater and performance.
I guarantee you, when amateur night and he had normal stand up, Andy Kaufman was a normal stand up for a year until he started tearing it up.
You can't be a true absurd
comedian without knowing what things to break.
Unless you're just the luckiest person on the planet.
I disagree. I don't believe it exists.
Yeah?
I mean, I don't think the pure talent can do absurd. Pure talent can do characters can do like even three beats maybe,
mm-hmm.
but you need to create and work hard to make absurd work.
Yeah. Steve Martin is a great example of that.
He is.
Yeah.
He is. Martin, and Andy Kaufman as well. I mean, good God, the talk show that he had where he had the desk that was like 4 feet higher than everybody else.
His ex-girlfriend, Elaine Boozler, was
It was just great. It was great.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. I guess I'm very picky with comedy. I'm not that picky with music. I'll listen to any. I'm a music whore, man. Bring me music. I'll listen to it. But when it comes to comedy, yeah, there is, I guess, I crave a certain structure. I crave a certain...
Ninja.
I guess there's a pattern that I look for. And to me, especially in the movie industry now, the stuff that comes out for comedy really to me is just so softball pitched over the plate.
Well, I was, in the workshop.
To me, it just seems like such lazy, lazy writing.
Yeah, you know what it is?
Yeah, tell them what you were saying.
Please.
Your thing is so like, oh, that makes so much sense.
Right. Part of it, what I was saying was that I think, I can do the story and plot thing, but also we've become joke obsessed.
Yeah.
And that's why sitcoms are mediocre, because it's jokes.
I wish I had my applause thing that I had for my
like a sitcom.
Yeah.
It's jokes in spite of the character, that break the character all the time.
Yeah.
So Big Bang Theory, as I said, maybe it's the best sitcom now, but it would be a middling sitcom in the 90s.
Mm.
Because I laughed, I saw the first 3-4 episodes and I laughed, but after a while I stopped caring. Because the characters were saying jokes that they would never say.
Yes. Yes.
And that builds up. You could do that once a year as a treat, and then, because people do that in real life. People do something, but if they do it all the time, they're not grounded people, and you lose interest in them.
Yeah, no, and I'm a comic book reader, and it's one of the things we talk about on Dudes and Beer. We're like, okay, like the last Superman movie, or not the last one, but Superman, one that came out before, you know, everything else, where it was like a horrible Lex Luthor, everything else. Like, number one, like wait a minute. It was
the one with Brandon Routh where they were like a sequel to the Richard Donner.
Exactly, okay. Exactly. Yeah, and it was one of those like, wait a minute, did Superman really just, don't tell me Superman didn't know Lois Lane was pregnant. He's got super hearing. He could hear the heartbeat like immediately. As soon as sperm and egg meet, he'd know he's Superman. He can tell. He would not leave to Krypton. Like, that is not in his character. What the hell are you doing?
Right.
And then on top of that, in the middle of the fight, he let some people get wasted at the freaking museum. It's like Superman would rather let Zod go than to let people die.
Ooh.
Like, why are you disobeying the rules of the character?
That's
why are you disobeying the rules of the universe that you set up?
And that's the other problem I have with movies nowadays. All these reimagining. To make it more pertinent to a younger audience, just do a different idea. Don't reimagine Ghostbusters. And I haven't seen it. I hear it's funny. But
I've heard it's really good. Actually.
Yeah, I hear it's good. So maybe it's a bad example, but I'm gonna keep on it. Do something else about a woman's movie. Reimagining, because you're breaking rules. And sometimes it works. Sometimes reimaginings do work, but that's all they do nowadays.
Sure. Well, and it's just like whenever I hear like one of the nearest and dearest to my heart that I could probably put it on mute and say every line, Fletch.
Yeah.
To hear the fact that they are actually considering rewriting Fletch, and to hear the fact that they're even considering Jimmy Fallon for the part of Fletch.
Oh, really?
I'm sorry, he does not have the comedic timing.
At least that
was
a book.
That's necessary for that, unless he's going to break character every 5 seconds.
At least that was a series of books.
I don't know, that's kind of what Chevy Chase did too. You know what I'm saying?
Chevy Chase is not a series of books.
It wasn't on the side to the camera, though.
Right.
Is what I'm saying.
Oh, right. Jimmy Fallon won't do that. I've not read the books, but I'm guessing that it's straight from the books to become more a Chevy Chase vehicle.
Sure.
So their ideas to be like closer to the books.
Well, yeah, and it's hard though to take such an iconic movie, even in comedy, because
it's an iconic movie. Is Fletch iconic?
Well, I mean, it's at least in my circle, people that I know, people in my age group. Yeah, it's one of those.
Yeah, the right age for it to be iconic.
Yeah.
It's kind of like
to me
that was an okay movie, Dave.
It's kind of like to me. Blazing Saddles is an iconic movie.
Yeah, I'm that age where...
Because it was groundbreaking. It was amazing. The comedy of Richard Pryor meets Mel Brooks.
If only Richard Pryor played the sheriff. The Cleavon Little was great, but imagine Richard Pryor doing his own shtick.
If he hadn't had the shtick in his personal life made them not be able to insure him on film, it would have been insane.
Because obviously... the stuff that I can't say that Cleavon Little says in Blazing Saddles. Yeah. That was obviously Richard Pryor.
Oh God, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh God, yeah. Yeah. Beautiful and amazing.
You know, I'm gonna take us to a different question because we're getting close to wrapping it up.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that I was most interested in talking to you about was how you've maintained the career, how you jump over the hurdles of the moments where you're like, ah, forget it, I'll be a bank manager. Or or maybe you don't hit those hurdles. Maybe you're like, there is literally nothing I ever want to do. And doesn't matter, how the gigs come, fast or slow, I'm in it to win it, whatever it is. How's the journey been for you? You're 3-4 years older than me, so I figure.
Thank you for lying right there.
Trying to recoup.
Thank you very much. There is no option for me. There's no option for me. Not only in what I said at the beginning that I have no other talents, not even that. I have no other interests. I wasn't necessarily born to succeed, but I was born to write comedy and act it out. That's what I was born to do. And also to improvise comedy, though I think that's a temporary thing and something you do for fun and something that helps educate you what you do when you write comedy. But that's just for me. Yeah. That's my own take. Mm-hmm. That's what I was born to do. When the kids in the hall stopped, I kept doing it without them. As I said, success or failure have nothing to do with it. There was a few years when the writing strike was going on, and then I moved to Winnipeg. And people thought I'd quit, and I thought, oh, no, I'm learning how to be a fake father to a family, but I'm writing, and it's the only thing that I'm interested in doing. It's really the only thing. I know if you do come back in another life, it'll be a similar thing. It's that strong in me.
No option for failure?
No option. Well, no, there's option for failure. There's no option to do anything else.
For giving up.
I guess that's what I mean.
There's no option for stopping it. Yeah.
Yeah.
When I moved to Winnipeg, and the strike, it had been 4 or 5 years, because not only was there a strike, when the strike was over, then the kids in Hallwalder hold ourselves up in Toronto, and we wrote and we shot our miniseries.
Mm.
So I was totally out of the Hollywood picture, but I never thought, oh, I've quit. Though I'm in Winnipeg, helping raise two kids, I started workshops and I started touring and I wrote pilots and I got the jobs again for writing pilots. It's just what I'll always do. I have no option, sadly.
Yeah.
To kind of continue on that, how do the failures, how do you handle the failures on the inside? Because like for me, I feel like in the beginning when I started, I was taking them way too hard. But the thing is it was shaping, I have to get embarrassed about failing in order to really, really make a hard right turn in a different way. So it doesn't hit me as hard now, especially first time you fail at stand up is the worst day of your life. And then everything else after that is fine. It's easy. Silence.
Well, that started with me. They're not failures. They're just, I didn't get a success that time.
Yeah. Yeah.
In the 2000s, I pitched a million shows. I got, 5 or 6 were picked and I got paid to writing them, but I never thought that was a success.
Okay. Yeah.
And then when, always what happened was the head of the studio would always quit and the next person wouldn't be interested. And that wasn't a failure. It's just, it was just, I really haven't reached success.
Right.
I still don't think I've made it. I was lucky enough to be in a great comedy troupe, and the comedy troupe made it.
Yeah.
But I still haven't done what I want to do. I still want to write and direct and act in my own movies. And I to this point, even with a second degree sunburn on my leg, I still feel that I have enough energy to get that done. I haven't made it, I mean it in a good, positive
right.
way.
So failure,
and I have
failure is not even the word you would really apply to any inconsistency in them.
It's impossible for me to be a has-been because I haven't made it yet.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, gotcha. Yeah.
That's so funny. Do you think, though, that it's not so much that you, quote, haven't made it, it's that you're just in a new, part of your goal system? When you were a kid, if we talked to 15-year-old you and told you what you were doing, they'd be like, oh, sweet! Whereas I'd be disappointed. Now you have a new goal.
I'd be, oh, that's great. What about all the movies I wrote and started? well, Brain Candy sort of counts, I guess. I'm still the 15-year-old kid who's still trying to achieve the same goal.
I believe in benchmarks, you know what I mean? Like, I believe in, like, certain levels of, like, being like, okay, well, my next sort of short-term goal is this. And then when I accomplish it, I'm like, excellent, next up.
Right.
And then I go to the next rung of my goal.
Like Jim Carrey, he was a Toronto, he's my age, he was, when he was 17, he was thought of the biggest thing in comedy. It took him forever to get to where he was. Then what do you do when you get there? And you're and you've done 7 or 8 hit movies. What do you do after that? I don't know. I read the Walt Disney biography, and he did kept doing the step up all the time.
Yeah.
And when he was dying, he was planning to build a city, like a
Oh no, that was the plan like actually city. For
why not?
And he was doing what you're saying.
That was the plan for Walt Disney World.
Yeah,
in Florida was to be a master plan community.
Yeah, he wanted it to be a real city.
Where, yeah,
where you did get to work in the Skyway, like from the house from your window to your house, to your, like stuff like that.
All the people that work for Disney right now are all like shuddering, like no, please let me go home.
I had a friend that actually, whenever I first started video editing, that was a monorail driver at Walt Disney World in Orlando. And yeah, it's like a master plan community. Like, you live on property. You live there.
Yeah.
There's like, something about the phrase master plan that doesn't make me feel good.
I know.
Yeah, but it lines up with a little bit of Walt Disney that I understand.
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a great article about out there about how the CIA helped him actually procure the property.
All right.
Ooh.
So back to Kevin McDonald's career.
Yeah. No, I'm the one that brought out the Disney book.
I was just saying,
I'm in a Disney thing. My voice is in a Disney world.
Oh, that's right.
Really lost its right.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'd sell my soul to Disney if they requested it, but... just in case anyone's listening, but at the same time, like, it's nice to have, you know, another goal. And it's good that you're like, okay, what I'm working on now is making movies and stuff like that.
It's the
like,
same goal I've always had. and it's sort of, I think it keeps me, I think I have that energy younger than my years. I probably look my years, but I feel that I have an energy that's younger.
Well, not to mention,
it's because of that.
And we were talking before about how you travel so much and you get to meet all these communities of people that are interested in doing this stuff. You have a network of people that would love to help you. You know what I mean? Like, my thought is, you know, I know that the end game is really to convince some studio to like give you millions of dollars to make this movie or whatever. But like, I don't know, you have the crowd of people that would like do stuff for you in such a huge way.
And it does give me energy. I have like an army of people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s that will follow me to the ends of comedy hell.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. And I'm going to start, I've written down a list of people who I think are good writers and stuff, and if my podcast I'm doing, if it ever becomes like a show, which is the Dream Like a Variety Show, I have lists.
And I have one final question for you. In my Talking Sound podcast, I ask artists and engineers, movie producers, stuff like this all the time. What if you had one piece of advice?
Good one.
For the upcoming writer, comedian, what have you, someone that wants to follow the passion in life that you have followed, that gives you the verve and zest to wake up every day on the daily and do what you love to do passionately.
Right.
It's such a blessing to wake up every day and literally get to do what you love to do. You're not doing it for anybody else but you. Right. And sure, it's selfish, but it's a beautiful thing as well. What would be the one piece of advice you would give them to be able to follow that path?
Well, first of all, realize it and then sort of respect it, it being the talent that you have. Yeah. We all have probably 7 or 8 talents. I think I only had one, but it was sort of, maybe it was good one and it was times 7. Respect by respected, I mean work on it all the time. Work on if you want to be a let's take one job for example. You want to be a sketch comic. You want to be a sketch writer and a sketch performer. You write sketches all the time. Here, I'll tell you the Kids in the Hall story. There was
beautiful.
Qualify for it, but the Kids in the Hall. That's a good one to end the podcast. The Kids in the Hall. You probably heard this 100 times. I'm sorry. When it was finally the 5 of us. We started doing a show at a club called the Rivoli. Every Monday was a new show of sketches. So we were working on it all the time. We felt that we were the best sketch comics in the world. We were sort of cocky, and we felt that. Now, sometimes people kid themselves. We luckily weren't. So all we did every day was get together and write sketches. Then on the weekend, we'd write premises. Then we'd write them and rehearse them. And then on Monday, we would do the show, all new sketches. We slowly built an audience. It went from 16 people for the first few months to 40 people to 60 people. And then we finally were selling out the 120 seat place we were playing. And for a year, we were sort of getting known. We worked on it every day. We worked very hard, as hard as you can in sketch comedy. And then on the, in the summer of 1985, Mark McKinney said, we have all these sketches. Why don't we rent a theater out and do a best of the Kids in the Hall show? It means work harder. So we did that. We became the week sort of was a big week for us. We got amazing reviews from a national paper in Canada. We went on the Peter Zowski CBC radio show, which means nothing to you people, but it was a big thing. Yeah, pretend that you know.
I'm familiar with it from a broadcast brand.
There you go. Yeah, Peter Zowski. Yeah. We were on Much Music, which is our MTV, like every day talking about it. It was we had to turn people away all the time. Now, what happened that a few weeks before that, Lorne Michaels, who had taken 5 years off of Saturday Night Live, he had announced his return. And he announced that he was going to get fresh new talent and that he was going to send talent scouts to all the major comedy cities in North America. Boston, New York, San Francisco, Chicago, Los Angeles, and one in Canada, Toronto, where he grew up. So on our last night of our Best Of show, the scout that he sent came to our show because all these reviews, you've read it. He came to the shows. He called Lorne Michaels that night. Lorne Michaels called the top Canadian agent in Canadian Canada, being redundant, who was also the wife of Dave Thomas from SCTV.
Oh, wow.
She called us all that night and said, I'm going to sign you guys. Come with me tomorrow. You have a conference call with Lorne Michaels. So I'm calling my my movie usher job saying, I have a conference call with Lorne Michaels and I'm signing with an agent, Dave Thomas. And he fell in love with it. I mean, at first, he just wanted us to Saturday Night Live, so he hired two of us as writers, Mark Moose. And a year later, he signed us all as a TV show. My point, and to answer your question, is I think you get two or three lucky breaks a year. But sometimes, but most of the time, we don't know it's a lucky break because we haven't worked hard enough and we're not ready. So embrace your talent, work on it all the time, and when your lucky break comes, you'll know that it's your lucky break and that you'll be prepared for it. Kevin McDonald, grade 7.
Beautiful.
Oh, show. Thank you, Kevin, so much for being with us. I appreciate it. Our audience of artists will be soaking it up, and hopefully they work harder. Work harder, everyone.
Work harder.
And,
but enjoy it. It's fun, remember.
Yeah. Well, that's what we're doing. We're having a wonderful time. Any final thoughts, Wendell?
See, I feel like this is something I was like, I have to say this to Kevin McDonald before the end of the podcast. Because I'm sure nobody ever references this when they come up and talk to you, but as a kid, one of my favorite movies that you were a heavy part in was National Lampoon's Field Trip. Yeah. I don't know. Just the character work you did as the Star Trek nerd who's like obsessed. And have you guys seen this movie?
Oh yeah.
See, now I was gonna say, I still have this VHS.
I was actually hanging out with the Griswold Mobile this last weekend at the car show I was at.
Okay, so, yeah, right on.
So I'm familiar with the oeuvre that is family.
But the eccentricity that was sort of like your defining character work was always just like these people that are very eccentric and very quirky and oddball helped me figure out why everybody was laughing at me and how I can control it.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, I was just like, oh, yeah, no, okay. Like, there are people that are awkward on purpose because it works, you know, and they can shape it as opposed to, like, a lot of people that just
that's
are
very
confused.
Nice.
And I hate that. I'm sure that that's not exactly, like, your proudest moments in film. I know you've
done it. No, but
I get it.
I know we're about to end, but I want to say I said a similar thing to my podcast to Wallace Shawn. He was my guest in a Dinner with Andre. I loved
amazing
it so
movie.
Much.
Yeah.
I loved what I was saying about art and stuff and people more than art. But what I liked most about it, what it taught me as what maybe my thing helped teach you, I'm sure other things like what I did, that any idea that I have, maybe it isn't embarrassing. Maybe every idea is interesting.
Yeah.
Because they probably had a dinner together and then they said, let's make this a movie.
Yeah.
And maybe the ideas I think are interesting are interesting. Yeah. So I understand what you're saying. Do you want to say one last thing?
Well,
you don't have to.
Jeez,
literally
the only way we end my podcast is if you can't be good at it. And that means you're exerting maximum effort all the time, regardless.
Right.
And the only way it's like I used to tell bands all the time, the only way you're ever going to make it is if you convince yourself that you are the best.
Right.
And yeah, it does take that super ego. It does take that, you know, like you said, I'm piggish. But
and then we saw people in Toronto who we knew weren't good comics who thought they were the best. So that makes you turn, especially if you're Canadian, inward, go, are we kidding ourselves?
Well,
just
can,
for a second.
You can only be shy and demure about it so long before you have to announce the world to the world that you are there and you're there to make a difference and you're there to do something.
Yeah.
And if you're really there to do something, you're going to make a way.
That's what he said
at
our wedding.
That being said, I was going to say, that's the, that I think is the difference between Canadians and people from the U.S. is that you turn yourself inside and you're like, oh no, are we kidding ourselves? Yeah. And people from the U.S. will see someone who's just like them that's a hack and be like, well, I'm better than that guy.
Yeah, I'm way better than that.
Mike Myers just said that to me in my workshop. Then we got to end the podcast. I got to get to the airport. But I'm the one talking. there was a guy in the workshop that was very broad. And I remember Mike Myers said to me, Mike Myers, he was 17, I was 19, and he was as brilliant as he ever was when he was 17. I always say I was a lumpy potato of potential. I knew that I had to keep learning. He was that. And he turns to me, this one guy who I knew was my first genius that I ever met, and he said, do I look like that guy? And I said, no. Thank you. Kevin,
thank you so much. You've been so sweet to me always. Thank you for coming to town and hanging out and working. It was
I
would have
hung out more if it wasn't for my blister.
No, it's okay. It's all right. I was like, I need to sleep too. I was like many hours of the workshop and everything.
Sorry.
So no, it was beautiful and wonderful. Thank you so much for being here and also coming to the podcast and you're welcome, microphone, and all of our listeners. This will be a wonderful podcast for them to listen to.
I can't wait to listen to it.
Hey. Oh.
Yeah.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to the Yes But Why podcast.